On December 26, 2004, Sonali Dharani Yagala was vacationing with her husband, her two sons, and her parents on the coast of Sri Lanka. The day was just beginning when she noticed that something strange was happening in the ocean. Within a matter of minutes, the sea would wipe out life as she had known it. In a new memoir called Simply Wave, she recalls her experience with the tsunami that killed more than 200,000 people, including her own family. NPR's Lynn Neary visited with the author at her home in New York.
When Sonali Dharani Yagala first moved to New York, she sublet an apartment in the village for 3 months. 5 years later, she's still there.
It's very brightly colored. It's not my choice of color or decor.
Dharani Yagala never meant to live in New York. It happened almost by accident. So, she says, did her book. She stayed because she found a therapist who helped her deal with her devastating loss in the tsunami of 2004. He suggested that she write down her memories, which she did, in the cozy loft bedroom of this apartment.
I've done all my writing up here. And I can only write in New York, and I can only write in the corner of that bed. I guess it's a kind of place of safety for me, and I needed to shut everything out. It's a cocoon.
Now, Dharani Yagala can talk calmly of the events of that day in 2004. It was a sunny morning, blue skies, no wind. Her parents had not yet emerged from their room. Her husband was in the shower. She and a friend were watching her two boys playing with the toys they had gotten for Christmas.
And she looked at them, and I think I told them off for something. Come on, don't make such so much noise or something. And she said, oh, they're so gorgeous. You know, I want to start a family soon. And she was single. And she said, oh, what you guys have is a dream. Yeah. And the next sentence was, oh, my God, the sea's coming in.
At first, it just seemed strange, not threatening. But quickly, they realized they had to get out. She and her husband grabbed the boys and ran. They hitched a ride on a Jeep, but soon it began filling with water. Her husband was sitting across from her, and suddenly she saw a look on his face that she had never seen before.
Well, I think he saw the wave when it was rising and when it was coming at us. The last I saw of Steve was that look on his face where he looked completely aghast, seeing something that I couldn't see. But I couldn't turn back. I didn't have time to turn back and look at what was that, because that's when the Jeep turned over and we all dispersed.
Dharani Yagala recalls what happened next in vivid detail in her book. In this excerpt from the audiobook, she describes what it felt like as she was swept into the great wave.
Am I underwater? It didn't feel like water, but it has to be, I thought. I was being dragged along and my body was whipping backwards and forwards. I couldn't stop myself. When at times my eyes opened, I couldn't see water. Smoky and grey, that was all I could make out. And my chest. It hurt like it was being pummeled by a great stone.
She thinks she was in the water for at least 20 minutes. At one point, the wave bounced her up to the surface, and she was able to grab onto a branch, the only one in her family to survive. They brought her to her aunt's house in Colombo.
For months on end, I couldn't come out of the room. I was terrified of everything. I didn't want to look. I didn't want to look at the sun. I couldn't look at grass, because I didn't want anything to remind me of our life, remind me of them. I wanted to guard myself against any kind of memory.
After she started to get better, her father-in-law asked her to return to the site of the disaster with him. At one point, while they were looking through the rubble, her father-in-law asked to be left alone for a moment.
He stood there and he spoke out aloud to Steve and the boys and said, oh, I hope you can hear me wherever you are. And at that moment, something fluttered, and it seems very unreal to me, at his foot, and it was a piece of paper. He picked it up eventually, and he put his glasses on, and he read it, and it was the back of a report, which was written by Steve. And that kind of really struck me. And since I found that, I went back obsessively looking for anything that belonged to us, because until that point, I was really terrified of even seeing something of ours. But then I started going back, digging around, looking for one of my boys' toys, maybe we took there or something.
It's like the book makes it clear that you have to, in some sense, you had to go back to each place where you were with them to kind of recreate them.
Yes. And eventually, 4 years later, I went back to our home in London. And that was something I was convinced for 4 years that I'd never do. But at the same time, I'd told my friends who were looking after the house not to change anything, to leave it. So there it was, just like, just as we'd left it. My first reaction was, gosh, it's like we've just stepped out. You know, it's all contained within these walls, all the traces of our life and all the debris of our life.
Gradually, Dereniagala came to understand that pushing away the memories and the physical reminders of her family would not help her overcome her grief. Instead, she has learned to embrace those memories, to draw light and spark from the life she and her family once shared. Dereniagala ends her book in a park at the bottom of her street, bordered on one side by a busy highway, on the other by the Hudson River. Coming here sometimes transports her to another time along another river, the Thames in London, with her husband and sons.
The boys would be running along just like this, running by the river, and it's drizzly, a bit like it is today, actually. The weather's quite perfect, this very London weather. And, you know, I'm saying, oh, let's hurry up, let's get home. And they're like, oh, Tower Bridge is going to open, you know, let's hang on. And yes, I do. I'm much more and more able to hold them both. Stand here on my own and then hold the feeling of us, as well, more than the memory of us even, the images and the feeling of us being together and by that river. So it's another vista. I'm always in kind of straddling two worlds.
There is no resolution to the grief she feels, says Dereniagala. But in writing about her family, she feels she has memorialized them and, in a way, has brought them back to life again. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. A Parisian Jew who dies in 1773 reappears in the 21st century as an angel fluttering gently down to earth, or so he thinks. He imagines himself as a fully formed Christian seraph, a Viking with blonde hair, a beautifully chiseled torso, and eyes the color of whiskey. So imagine his shock when he realizes he's no angel. He's actually been reincarnated as a common housefly. And that unlikely insect is the narrator of a wild new novel by Rebecca Miller. She's also been a painter, an actress, and film director, as well as a writer. Her new book, Jacob's Folly, veers between 18th century Paris and present-day Long Island, in particular, a family of Orthodox Jews. Rebecca Miller, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The fly, who is formerly the Jewish peddler from Paris, Jacob Cerf, has supernatural powers, right? He can read minds, and he can actually will people to do what he wants them to do.
Yes. He realizes the scope of his powers gradually in the narrative. And then once he realizes he's a fly, he's so angry at the form of his reincarnation.
What bad luck.
That he decides to sort of get back at God.
Yeah, he wants to punish God by doing malevolent things, right? By taking good people and turning them bad.
Yes. But yet, I wouldn't call Jacob an evil character. He's mischievous and sometimes malevolent, but he has his own transformation through the arc of the story.
What's so interesting is that as lusty as Jacob Cerf the peddler was back in 18th century Paris, he's just as lusty as a 21st century fly. And there's a moment, a great moment, when the fly has landed on the Sabbath table of the Edelman family on Long Island. It's this huge feast. They've got salmon roulade and pistachio stuffed chicken breast and hummus and blueberry cobbler. And I wonder if you could read from that section.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely will. It was paradise. With a shudder of pleasure and surprise, I stepped into a droplet of gravy and tasted the rich, salty fat through the pads in my feet. In a trance of sensory overload, I strolled from one luscious crumb to another, sometimes even flying to a serving dish to drink from the rim, knowing full well that my hosts were forbidden to kill anything, even flies, on the Sabbath. These people were not even allowed to wash lettuce after Friday sundown, lest they kill the bugs hidden in the leaves. I was completely safe. They shooed me away several times, of course, but nobody dared swat me. Elishai's husband, Yitzhak, a humorist, even quipped, "He's a Jewish fly. He knows we can't kill him today." I laughed at that joke along with the rest of the party.
You know, I was thinking about the life of Jacob Cerf in Paris and how you carry him through these various chapters of his life in these really fascinating, you know, picaresque ways. And I wonder if it was just joyful for you in the morning to sit down and think about, you know, what can I do with Jacob next? What fun adventure or sexual escapade can I throw his way?
Yes, writing Jacob was a great joy. And in fact, I had to work really hard for this book, but there was a gift, and it was Jacob's voice that seemed to kind of come through my feelings in some way. And once I heard how he sounded inside of my head, I was able to figure him out. And yes, writing him was a joy because he's so free, and he's not somebody who's controlled by guilt at all.
At heart, the book is about two characters who both lose or give up what was their very deeply held Jewish faith, both in 18th century Paris and 21st century Long Island. What was it that interested you about that?
Well, I was interested in the allure and also freedom and also pitfalls of assimilation and in the hidden beauties of actually belonging to a community which is much more certain than our more secular world. So I came into it really not understanding very much at all about the Orthodox Jewish life, real Torah Judaism, and ended up seeing, as well as understanding more firmly why I couldn't be part of it, understanding the beauty of their community.
And the other side of the world that's also in this book is the lives of Jewish peddlers in 18th century Paris, lugging boxes full of knives and hammers and snuff boxes and things like
yes.
that. How did you find out about that world? What was your research like there?
Well, I did go to Paris and went to the museums and walked the streets, etc. But I really, before that, I found a wonderful researcher named Max McGinnis. Together, we really had to try to crack the case of Jews in Paris in the 18th century because there were so few. There were about 500 of them. Most of the evidence for their lives is the police reports, because there was a particular sort of policeman who was the inspector in charge of Jewish affairs at the time, whose job it was to really record the comings and goings and, in fact, character and occupation of every single male Jew in Paris. And sometimes if they had families and who they lived with in their apartment, whose apartment they lived in, what they sold, if they had been arrested for being in Paris without a passport. They were very strictly monitored. And so those police reports really were like a gold mine for me. And in fact, I used a lot of the actual names of the Jews. I used the name of Inspector Buhol, which was in fact his name. So I grounded my writing really in the reality of what I found.
I'm talking with Rebecca Miller. Her novel is called Jacob's Folly. Rebecca, I mentioned earlier your other artistic lives as an actor and a painter and a film director. I should mention that your mother was the photographer Inga Morath, your father was the playwright Arthur Miller, and your husband is the actor Daniel Day-Lewis. Does it seem that your background as a painter, or maybe anything you inherited through your artistic mother and father, comes through in your writing? In other words, that visual sensibility from, at least from your own experience as an artist and your mom as a photographer?
Probably. I think certainly I'm a very visual writer. I tend to try to communicate emotion and ideas through visual means so that you see it in your eye of your mind. And I think I have an ear for dialogue, which I remember listening to my father read his plays out loud all the time. And I think I might have inherited certainly a real fascination with dialogue and character. But it's always difficult to know, mm-hmm. you know, where everything comes from.
Yeah. Do you imagine Jacob's Folly as a movie? It would be fun to shoot Jacob as the fly.
I know. It's tempting. It's very visual, and it could be funny. But I think I need distance. In the past, I always had the technique that I would not let the scab form. I would just, you know, write the book and then immediately, if I was going to write the screenplay so that – because I always had this feeling like you can never go back. You can never be – because you're not the same person 5 years away. You're not the same person. You might not even understand it anymore, what you wrote. But now with this one, I have a feeling that if I ever do it, it would be better if I have a little distance.
Rebecca Miller, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Miller's new novel is titled Jacob's Folly.
Pat Summitt was head coach of the University of Tennessee Lady Vols basketball team for 38 years. She won more games than any other coach in college basketball, men's or women's. Now the ferocious coach is facing her toughest opponent, Alzheimer's disease. Even as her memories fade, Summitt has captured her story in a new memoir out today called Summitt Up. Pat Summitt and her co-author Sally Jenkins spoke with NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
The image of Pat Summitt for many fans is that of a madwoman decked out in orange, yelling to her players from the sideline. But then, in 2011, she was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's.
When I first was diagnosed, I was in disbelief. But after that, I knew what I was facing, and I wanted to get it out there, and that's exactly what I did.
She went public with the diagnosis, and it's the first story she tells in the new book. After the end of the 2012 season, Summitt retired. Pat Summitt grew up, Tricia Head, in the tiny town of Henrietta, Tennessee.
You say we were hardscrabble, self-made people. Talk about that.
Well, growing up on a dairy farm, we had cows. We had to milk them 5 a.m. and 5 p.m. And my parents, they just really made all of us aware of what we had to do every day when we went to work. And so, you know, I think it was a good thing for me.
Hard work followed by hard play, drag racing on country roads, basketball games in the hayloft of their barn, where Pat first saw equality on the court. She says it didn't much matter to her older brothers that she was a girl.
It sounds like you were taking your life in your hands to be in that game.
Well, let's just say we were in the hayloft and we just started battling. It was something that we loved to do.
Fight.
Yeah, we fought a little bit.
You just heard Sally Jenkins, who co-wrote the book and has been writing with and about Pat Summitt for more than a decade. She says Pat was a competitor throughout her career and in this current battle.
What she does better than anybody in the world is fight. Her brothers would tell you that, her players would tell you that, and her opponents would certainly tell you that.
Pat Summitt says in the book that, looking back, her career path was a straight, determined march forward. She was head coach of women's basketball at Tennessee at 22. In 1976, she played in the first Olympics that recognized women's basketball.
You were a very tall, skinny girl from a little tiny place in Tennessee, and somehow you decided that you wanted to play basketball in the Olympics. I wonder what made you raise your eyes so high.
My dad is the one that said that's what I needed to do, and I was like, I don't know if I could be an Olympian. I don't know what being an Olympian was what, but my dad really influenced me to stay and be in the Olympics.
Your father was a man who didn't talk much and didn't tell you that he loved you a lot, although you felt that he did. Somehow he gave you what you needed to be who you are. Do you think that's right?
Yes, I do.
Why? How did he do it?
Well, I think he treated me like one of the boys, and I kind of liked it that way. Because being on the farm, you know, everybody had to go to work every day. And he knew that I was going to go to work just like the guys did.
Everything changed for Pat Summitt after Congress passed the Equal Opportunity in Education Act, which included Title IX. That eventually meant equal opportunity for women in college sports.
It just opened the doors for a lot of players that wanted to play basketball. We didn't have to go play with the guys. We just did what we wanted to do. You know, I thought it was important. That was the best time of my life as far as coaching.
Sally, what is the word that you would use to describe Pat Summitt?
Subversive. We had this conversation years ago. I asked Pat if she was a feminist. And she said, no, I'm not a sign carrier. And I said, well, I know what you are. You're a subversive. And she said, that's exactly right. I think Pat took the concept of athletics that was used to define confidence and excellence for men and stole it and gave it to women.
Well, now, as a person who's watched you at the sidelines on TV, I would have said tough, way past tough. And in your book, you talk about how you had to be very tough on your players, especially some of the big stars. Did you ever think you were too tough?
Not really. You know, I think you can challenge people, but you don't want to break people down. But you've got to sometimes just pull them aside and say, you know, you're okay, but you can be better.
You have to know when to push and when to stop.
Yes.
And just because someone cried, you didn't stop, right?
Right. That was my father and me.
Pat Summitt coached the Lady Vols to 8 national championships, from no uniforms, no dressing rooms, no attention, to the superstar team in women's basketball. This book is full of wonderful memories, but now Pat Summitt cannot always call them up. Here's one. In 2008, in the Final Four, with 7 seconds to go, she sent her best shooter, Candace Parker, down the court with orders to pass. ESPN called that play.
Parker, nice dish inside, tip, the follow is good! Hornbuckle with the follow, 2/10 of a second to go. Are you kidding?
When I ask you about a critical moment in an all-important game, can you remember that event?
Not for sure.
So some of this stuff is clear and some of this stuff isn't clear.
Exactly.
In her book, Pat Summitt was asked if she would trade her trophies for her health. She hesitated and finally said, I'd give up all my trophies to still be coaching. So, Pat Summitt, do you still feel that way?
I do.
What is it about coaching that makes you feel like that?
I love the game. I miss it now, not coaching, but I'm moving on in that regard.
Do you still watch the young players coming up and take a look and see if you still see the big talent?
Oh, yes. And I go to practice, you know, every day. I love being around the student athletes. That's something that I'll always like.
So do you talk to them and try to help every once in a while?
Oh, yes. I stick my nose out frequently.
Linda Wertheimer speaking with Pat Summitt and Sally Jenkins. Their new book is Sum It Up.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Author Jamaica Kincaid is back with a controversial new novel, her first in 10 years. Perhaps best known for her books At the Bottom of the River and The Autobiography of My Mother, Kincaid's new book tackles some hard themes. See Now Then opens with a scene of seemingly idyllic home life in small-town Vermont, but it's soon clear that the marriage of Mr. and Mrs. Sweet is anything but sweet. The book traces that marriage's painful unraveling in an unusual narrative that bucks the traditional style. In the decades since Kincaid's last novel, she says she's kept busy writing and trying to figure out how to make this book work.
It's not a book in the usual way of and then, and next. It doesn't have what you'd call a traditional structure or a traditional narrative, but it is very structured, it's very mannered, actually, in the way your mind might work. I mean, I've come to think that the traditional way of writing is the artificial way, that that's not the way things work at all. It's not the way thinking works. And in the book itself, I mean, it made sense because the characters in it are not like characters who cross the street and brush their teeth. They never brush their teeth. You'd think they must be very fragrant people.
They're not flesh and blood.
No, they're not. They are mythic.
Yeah, and you've named many of the characters after Greek
mythology. That's right.
And mythology.
That's true. The son is named Heracles, and the daughter is named Persephone, and they're always described as the beautiful Persephone, the young Heracles.
Well, Persephone was beautiful, but she was also the queen of the
underworld.
Dead.
Yes. She was the queen of the dead, but she was captive and away from her mother, and her mother mourns for her and longs to see her. And so on. And all of those things are particular to the story. They're symbolic in the story, and they're also real in the story. The book operates on two levels, you know, with a sort of reality and then a sort of interpretation.
I mean, as you were alluding to earlier, it's not chronological. It almost is like a dream in that things just happen. And because of that, and the title, and the fluidity of time in the novel, I wonder if maybe time isn't the real flesh and blood, real character, memory.
Oh, you must have really read this novel. Time is the main character. Time is the element that controls the consciousness, the very being of the people. I started out thinking, what is this thing we call time? And it started in this way. Every day I see a photograph of myself taken when I was 2 years of age. And I would look at it and wonder, well, what happened to that two-year-old? Where did it go? And there are all sorts of explanations. You know, we grow up, we grow old, we change. But none of it is a good explanation for where is the two-year-old. And so it's from that, really, I began to contemplate all the things that had happened, how I came to be the person sitting in a small village in New England.
And that's kind of the subplot to me, anyway, what I took away, was how our memories are created, and you can't trust them. I mean, you don't even know in the novel what is real and what it isn't.
Yes.
And you have created some scenes that are graphic and horrifying,
yes.
Visions of decapitation. It's as though you're trying to suggest that we can't trust our own memory.
Yes, but that is not to some degree, that is wholly true, that you can't trust it. For one thing, the thing that is happening to you might be so unpleasant, you may need to subtract from it or add to it so that in the retelling, you can manage it.
You know, a lot has been said and written about the parallels between this book and your own life. The mm-hmm. the main character, Mrs. Sweet,
yes.
is also a writer. She
yes.
also lives in a small New England town.
Yes.
She also is an avid gardener.
Yes.
I don't have to go through all of them. There are a lot of parallels.
Yes.
But I wonder why it matters. I mean, if it's a great piece of art,
that's the thing that is interesting to me. Why does it matter? It doesn't matter to me that it's autobiographical, but it seems to matter to people as a way to read it, you know. Except I think it's a way of diminishing what's, I think, might be remarkable about the work. And it's painful in its way to be dismissed because, well, it's about her marriage and revenge or something. It's not that at all. None of that was on my mind. My own everyday life was not on my mind so much, but how to render something that had happened, how to make sense of it. You know, men write about their life all the time. You know, Norman Mailer would put himself in his books.
It's true.
And no one made it seem that he was doing something less.
No, they were just drawing on personal experience.
Yes. I do have to say that I notice, and I don't like to say these things, but I just think it has to be said that if I had looked different, my autobiography in the book, or any kind of autobiography in the book, would not be held against it.
You mean if you were not a female, or if you were not from Antigua, if you were not dark-skinned?
All of the above and more. That sometimes I feel that there is a certain kind of book that I should have written that is expected of someone like me, the travails of the black woman, the travails of history. There is all the travails of history, certainly, is in the book, but it's not about the black woman or the black this. It's about a human experience, that the life of this family doesn't depend on the color of their skin.
No, although the husband is racist, and his family was too.
I wouldn't say they were racist. I would say that they didn't understand her, and she didn't understand them. Why are they racist?
Were you asking me why I thought they were racist? Well, I mean, the continued emphasis on her coming in from a banana boat, the continued assumptions they make about her based on where she came from and based on her race.
That's not the way I meant it at all. That particular section, you know, has to do with the history of certain powerful actors, for instance, the British Empire. It's her foreignness, not her race. Race is almost not the way I think so much, but I see that it's something that is attributed to me, and the way people perceive me is my race. I perceive the world as powerful and powerless, and Mrs. Sweet comes from the history of the powerless. See, the thing about race, one can imagine that if the world had gone the other way, we'd be talking about these things in a different matter. I mean, if you look at life in a way as a kind of musical chairs, and when the music stops, who's sitting down and who's standing up? At one point, it very well might have been that the people from Europe are the ones doing the standing up, and the people who look like me might be sitting down and pushing them around. It's all very arbitrary. It's why you can't take these things not only for granted, but you can't assume that they're fixed. They're always in flux. Maybe not in our lifetime, yours and mine, but they're in flux.
Jamaica Kincaid, the new book is called See Now Then. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish, and it's time now for the latest Backseat Book Club pick. That's when the program offers up a special treat for those in the backseat. We look for books that transport us to interesting places. And this month, it's a novel by Gary D. Schmidt. It's called Okay for Now. The story takes us to 1968. NPR's Michelle Norris takes us there.
We meet middle schooler Doug Swiatek in the middle of summer, a good time of year if you're a Yankee fan like Doug.
7 complete innings, New York 6, Baltimore 4.
And man, is it hot. So hot, Doug jumps in the sprinkler to try and keep cool. But Doug is anything but a happy-go-lucky kid. Author Gary Schmidt lays out Doug's story.
He has a beat-up situation, a beat-up family, beat-up house, and he comes to a new town trying to find a new way to start. But he brings all of his beat-upness with him. In the course of time, he comes to a library, and there he finds an amazing book, a beautiful book, Audubon's Birds of America, and sees that what's happened is that 9 of the plates, these beautiful plates of birds, have been razor-bladed out and have been removed from the book and sold independently. And Doug, who is so beat up, wants one thing in his life, just one thing in his life that's whole. And he resolves that he will try and get all 9 of those plates back. He has no resources, no way to do it, but he's determined. And so this is a novel about this kid trying to do that and surrounded by people who come to love and cherish him.
When he first enters the library, it's the Maryville Public Library. It's only open on Saturdays, which tells you something about this small town and the resources in that small town. What does he see when he gets there?
He sees a table, a low table with a case on top of it, a glass case, and this is the scene. Underneath the glass was this book, a huge book, a huge, huge book. Its pages were longer than a good-sized baseball bat. I'm not lying. And on the whole page, there was only one picture of a bird. I couldn't take my eyes off it. He was all alone, and he looked like he was falling out of the sky and into this cold green sea. His wings were back. His tail feathers were back, and his neck was pulled around as if he was trying to turn but couldn't. His eyes were round and bright and afraid, and his beak was opened a little bit, probably because he was trying to suck in some air before he crashed into the water. The sky around him was dark, like the air was too heavy to fly in. This bird was falling, and there wasn't a single thing in the world that cared at all. It was the most terrifying picture I'd ever seen. The most beautiful.
Now, Doug is talking about the bird, but when he talks about the bird falling and that there wasn't a single thing in the world that cared at all, there was almost a communion for him, wasn't there? He was not just talking about that bird.
Absolutely. He looks at that picture and he sees his own life. He sees a bird or a living thing that's so beautiful. falling out of the sky with nothing to support him at all. And in reality, the bird isn't falling out of the sky. He's going down to get something to eat. But Doug's perception is that he is alone and in trouble. And he, of course, is thinking about his own life. And I hope that's true for all the pictures all the way through.
Gary Schmidt puts a lot of trust in his young readers, trust that they will fill in the blanks when the emotionally beat-down Doug is slow to reveal all the complexities in his young life, and trust that they can handle the difficulties brought on by the adults in Doug's life, the abusive alcoholic father, the diabolical gym teacher, and the impact on everyone when Doug's big brother is injured in Vietnam.
I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
You couldn't have been an adolescent during Vietnam and not been deeply affected by it and still carry that with you. On some level. I mean, when the draft comes in and suddenly people that you know are being drafted and they're only a few years older than you and they're going to Vietnam. But the wars that middle school and high school kids are seeing or are living through are so, so hidden and they seem so far away. But during Vietnam, I mean, it's in our faces all the time. And I wanted to write a book that showed that this is what war is like, and that when you're growing up, it really is the case that these can be in your face and that they will affect how you act. And at the same time, I mean, this amazing thing, this wonderful space event that we're heading towards the moon, it's unbelievable. And all of those things are happening so fast. There are space flights every 2 months or so heading up to the moonshot, and how exciting that was.
When you were young, say, about Doug's age, what was your favorite book?
Wow. Books when I was young, when I was very young, were sort of threatening to me. I was tracked. We had a tracking system where you were put into various categories. And if you're track one, you're the college-bound kid. If you're track two, you'll have a good job. If you're track three, you're the stupid kid. And I was tracked as track three. And that meant that we had few books in my early grades and that we were the kids. I mean, we were going to serve French fries McDonald's the rest of our lives, so I guess they didn't need to read. And so early on, I didn't have favorite books because I didn't like books. And then I was taken up by a great, great teacher, the story that everyone should have, who just liked me and who one day walked into my track three classroom, no kidding, and she takes me by the hand and she says, come with me. And I left my track three classroom and I walked with her to her track one classroom and she put me in a desk that was right beside hers and she had stuffed it with books, most of which were below my grade level, but which I couldn't read because I was track three and I was stupid. And she taught me how to read, and I grew to love them. And I think the first one I really, really loved, I mean, I really, really loved, was a book called The Big Jump by someone that we don't read anymore. His name was Benjamin Elkin. And it was one of the first six I Can Read books, or beginner books. It was in the series that Cat in the Hat was in, about a boy who is presented with all sorts of problems, this is going to sound familiar, and his own wit and guts gets him through it. It's a brilliant book. The Big Jump by Benjamin Elkin.
What was that teacher's name?
Miss Kabakoff.
Do you keep in touch with her?
No, I haven't. And it was so many years ago. So I have not. I've completely lost touch with her. But I wouldn't be talking to you right now if it wasn't for Miss Kabakoff.
Maybe she's listening. Wouldn't that be something?
I hope so. She was amazing.
Well, in honor of Miss Kabakoff, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure for me too. Thank you.
That was author Gary Schmidt remembering his favorite book as a kid. His latest book, Okay for Now, this month's Backseat Book Club pick, is sure to be one of your favorites. Head to npr.org to learn more about the book and the art of John James Audubon. I'm Michelle Norris, NPR News.
The next Backseat Book Club book will touch people across generations. It's a timeless classic, The Wizard of Oz, not the film, the book. So click your heels three times, read along, and send your emails to backseatbookclub@npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.